as a Doska basis, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the March 2024 issue of Arizona Highways. I'm going to start out today with Arizona microgreens. The stereotype suggests that you have to be an executive chef or an earthy, crunchy hippie to use microgreens, but they're ideal for the mainstream too. They're quicker and easier to use than other greens, says Joseph Martinez of Arizona Microgreens, articles written by Amima Ahmed. Since 2013, brothers Joseph Martinez and David Redwood have been running a small family farm growing small leafy greens in the middle of a big city. As the name suggests, Arizona Microgreens specializes in greenhouse-grown microgreens, shoots that are picked just after the first leaves develop. We didn't initially start out with a plan to grow into a business. The initial plan was just to do a project and work together, Martinez says, but it kind of scaled naturally from there. After a few weeks, we added a farmer's market presence. A few weeks after that, we had chefs approach us, and these days, Arizona Microgreens is supplying to restaurants, schools, and hospitals, in addition to selling at farmers markets and online. Gregory James, executive chef at Sanctuary Camelback Mountain, has been using Arizona Microgreens for nearly a decade. He says he already knows the product he is getting is top-notch, and that he likes getting it from a local farm. It's harvested at peak freshness, which ensures we are getting the most flavor and shelf life, he says. But for James, using microgreens isn't only about garnishing a dish with the leafy greens. It's also about adding thoughtfulness and flavor. He uses the cilantro, for example, on his restaurant's Wagyu dumplings. We love the mild cilantro flavor with accents of pepper and lemon, he says. The cilantro has the ability to be on the hot dumplings for a short period of time without melting. Microgreens aren't only for professional chefs and gourmet home cooks. Martina says people who want a low-effort healthy food can cook with them too. People think you have to be like a fanatic to use microgreens, but it's actually the opposite, he says. They're quicker and easier to use than other greens. Our customers are people who want to open up a box and just put a little bit of dressing on it and not do much else. Arizona Microgreens grows its greens in organic soil using organic seed and no pesticides or herbicides. The plants grow in trays inside a greenhouse outfitted with benching systems, allowing the brothers to grow all year, unlike other local farms that stop growing during the hot summer months. We operate year-round, and we are really focused on and committed to local, Martina says. We never sell our product out of state, and we only work with local produce distributors. The farm offers about a dozen varieties of microgreens, including basil, cilantro, broccoli, and purple radish. Martina says his favorites are sunflower shoots. I don't think many people know they can eat sunflower greens, he says. But if you plant the two halves of a sunflower seed, they'll turn into two leaves. These sunflower shoots are rich in protein, have great flavor, and they're leafy greens that you can add to salads, sandwiches, or smoothies. But for people who find the idea of using microgreens daunting, Martina suggests starting with the company's micro salad mix. We had a guy try our salad mix at a farmer's market, and he said, "When I eat this, my body feels good," Martina says. I think that's a great statement. If you eat something and your body is like, yes, listen to that. And while Martinez enjoys hearing comments like that, he says he also loves partnering with organizations and businesses. Something wonderful that we've gotten to experience is working with hospitals, schools, retailers, and even researchers, he says. We've been approached by people who are doing research for those who have cancer and other diseases to talk about the chemical compounds of microgreens. Arizona microgreens are available for purchase at several farmers markets in the valley and can also be ordered online. Learn more about what Arizona microgreens has growing for it in a video at arizonahighways.com/local favorites. And this concludes Arizona microgreens. Next up, editor's letter from the April 2024 issue of Arizona Highways. We drove more than 1,000 miles to get to Yellowstone. It was a long drive from my boyhood home in rural Wisconsin, and it seemed even longer because I was riding in the camper with my brother. As a collection of words, riding in the camper might sound especially comfortable, like a first-class flight to Singapore, but it wasn't all it seems. Although we had our own beds and plenty of legroom, we couldn't see anything from back there. The small side windows were only slivers of light, and looking through them was like looking through a mail slot in a castle door. There was a bigger window on the back of the camper, but see Minnesota and South Dakota in reverse is like playing a Beatles record backward. It's interesting for a few minutes, but it's not the same as hearing it the way George Martin intended. So we just sat there like table lamps in the back of a U-Haul. The drive was long, but there was no other way. There weren't any national parks or national monuments in Wisconsin. We had a national seashore up on the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee, but it wasn't one of the marquee parks or something you'd see on the cover of National Geographic. It took determination to get to Yellowstone, no matter where you were sitting. We made it, though, and driving through the entrance gate was like driving into the dreams of Henry David Thoreau. It was enchanting and beautiful. Old Faithful and the Grand Prismatic Spring were part of it, but so were the park rangers in their flat hats and the rustic architecture and the wildlife and the gift shops and the scenic overlooks and the unspoiled nature of things. Wallace Stegner was right. National parks are the best idea we ever had. I was hooked, and even then, at the age of 8 or 9, I knew it was important to protect places like Yellowstone. By the time I got to Chiricahua National Monument 2 decades later, I was even more convinced. The first time Arizona Highways did a story about the monument was in September 1925, a year and a half after it was created. The story gives a glowing review. Someone in the not-far-distant past execrated Arizona as the land that God forgot. A.H. Gardner wrote, quote, "What a gross calumny. What perverted appraisal of a land infinite in a vast variety of natural phenomena. And if the better known wonders of the youngest state are not sufficient to bring a merited respect from time to time, the veil is drawn aside and a new contribution is revealed. The newest of these is the Valley of Graven Images, Chiricahua National Monument." 2 paragraphs later, his praise continues. "What is there to see there?" he asked. The answer is, "The greatest work of nature upon rock formations up to this time registered in the knowledge of man, not only in the United States, but anywhere." People like to compare the hoodoos in Chiricahua to those in Bryce Canyon. Like Donnie and Marie, there's a definite resemblance. The hoodoos have similar names, too, but the names in Chiricahua are more interesting. In 1925, Mr. Gardner singled out a few. The formations, he wrote, owing to their semblance to animate objects, have been given names. For instance, there is Andy Gump, the Face, the Lizard, Judge Rumhauser, the Old Hen, the Shoe, the Totem Pole, Thor's Hammer, the Water Jug, Sweet Potato, Punch and Judy, Old Lady Sniff Sniff, the Sheep, the Three Brothers, the Camel, and hundreds of other rock formations representing almost anything of which one can think. Old Lady Sniff Sniff, Andy Gump, Judge Rumhauser. I've been to Chiricahua at least 20 times, and I've seen thousands of captioned photographs from the park, but I wasn't familiar with any of those names. I was curious, so I asked Suzanne Moody, a longtime park ranger at the monument. "That must be from an old source," she says, "because most of the named formations as listed are no longer recognized. Is it from the Arizona WPA guide?" "No," I said, "it's from Arizona Highways, 99 years ago. Turns out, only Punch and Judy, Thor's Hammer, and the Camel still exist. The Sheep would be around too," Suzanne said, "but its legs broke off in the 1950s or 1960s, so it's gone." Most of the hoodoos you see today were named by crew members of the Civilian Conservation Corps during their occupation of the park in the 1930s. Our story was written before that, so Old Lady Sniff Sniff, Andy Gump, and Judge Rumhauser came from somewhere else. I figured the judge might have been a lawman from Tombstone. He wasn't. He wasn't even real. Judge Alexander Rumhauser was a protagonist in a comic strip called Judge Rummy. The artist was T.A. Dorgan, who created several popular cartoons for newspapers in the Hearst Empire. He also ended up in the International Boxing Hall of Fame. In spite of those triumphs, his most enduring legacy is that he coined several American slang expressions, including dumbbell, the cat's meow, and for crying out loud. Andy Gump was a character in a comic strip too, a self-important man who was bald and toothless and beloved. The Gumps was one of the most popular comic strips in the country in the 1920s and 1930s. Some of those strips are in the Library of Congress. I read a few. They stand the test of time, but not Old Lady Sniff Sniff. I couldn't find anything about her. It seems she left the world without a trace. Maybe one of you knows something. If you do, please let me know. Meanwhile, I'll be headed back to the monument later this month to do some hiking with one of our photographers. It's one of my favorite places in Arizona and one of my favorite parks in the country. I'd drive 1,000 miles to get there, even in the back of a camper. Happy 100th, Chiricahua National Monument. And this concludes Editor's Letter. The next article is entitled, On This Day in Rock History. 27 million years ago, a volcanic eruption laid the groundwork for what would become a stone forest of pinnacles, columns, and spires. Millions of years later, President Calvin Coolidge designated that cosmic landscape as Chiricahua National Monument. This month, on April 18th, that beautiful monument turns 100. Articles written by Kathy Montgomery. On Labor Day in 1934, some 7,000 visitors crowded onto Masai Point for the dedication of Chiricahua National Monument. While the Bisbee High School Bugle Corps played and dignitaries expounded, Civilian Conservation Corps enrollees sweated over 8,000 pounds of beef roasting in an 85-foot-long barbecue pit that blasted out of solid rock for the occasion. National Park Service Chief Engineer Frank Kittredge was the first of several government representatives to speak. Since touring the monument 5 months earlier, Kittredge had become one of its biggest boosters. In all the national park and monument areas, I know of nothing comparable, he wrote to the editor of the Douglas Daily Dispatch. The view from Masai Point can't help becoming nationally famous and will rank along with some of the great spectacles of the country. The dedication was about a decade overdue, but there was a lot to celebrate. Not much had happened at the monument since President Calvin Coolidge had established it in 1924, but the road to Masai Point had just been completed, the CCC camp business leaders had lobbied for had been established, and hopes for the monument's future looked as bright as the sun in the crystal blue sky. And now, as the monument celebrates its April 18th centennial, with 3 days of special programming this month, legislation working its way through the U.S. House and Senate would, if passed, make Chiricahua National Monument Arizona's fourth national park. A century is a blink in geological time, and that's especially true of the monument, which was created to protect the fantastical formations that resulted from volcanic eruptions 27 million years ago. Over time, natural forces fused the pumice and ash, then eroded it into a stone forest of pinnacles, columns, and spires that look as though they were sculpted by a crazy cosmic hand. People who came to the area couldn't help seeing these towering hoodoos in human terms, giving them names such as Old Maid and China Boy. In 1940, Joyce Rockwood Munch saw stone faces everywhere. Through vistas in the trees, one is aware of crowds of rock people watching from the canyon walls, she wrote in Arizona Highways. It's as if a whole village were frozen in a monument in time, with villagers captured in earnest conversation, Punch and Judy, or in Mid-Kiss, the Kissing Rocks. And over them all, Cochise, whose band of Apaches raided from these mountains, lies in internal slumber in the form of Cochise Head. Perhaps it's fitting that we see ourselves in these formations. The record of human occupation in the monument is rich and layered. Sometime before 1200, indigenous people were climbing Sugarloaf Mountain to leave offerings. The land was also sacred to the Apaches, who came to listen to the voices of departed family members and use the future monument's canyons for passage through the Chiricahua Mountains. After the U.S. Army's truce with Cochise in 1872, the future monument briefly became part of the Chiricahua Reservation. Home to about 1,000 Apaches at its peak, the reservation was abolished after 4 years and its residents removed to the San Carlos Reservation. Cochise didn't live long enough to see that, but Geronimo did. When the storied medicine man and his followers escaped from San Carlos in 1881, they hid out in the Chiricahuas, unsettling the earliest white settlers. According to family lore, Yahoo Stafford, the first to file a homestead in the present-day monument, located as well inside his cabin for safety. Stafford and his family must have breathed a little easier when the 10th Cavalry Regiment set up camp nearby. From 1885 until Geronimo's capture the next year, the African American regiment, dubbed the Buffalo Soldiers by the Plains Indians, occupied Bonita Canyon. The soldiers left a monument to President James Garfield, who supported giving black people the right to vote, but was assassinated in 1881 after less than a year in office. Decades later, the hand-carved stones from the Deterioran Monument were repurposed as a house fireplace at the nearby homestead, now known as Faraway Ranch. Geronimo's escape wouldn't be Stafford's last scare. After surrendering, a man named Asai escaped from a train carrying captive Apaches to Florida and may have turned up in Bonita Canyon in 1890. Swedish immigrant Neil Erickson, who had moved to Bonita Canyon 2 years earlier, captured the incident in his memoirs. This bright and early May morning, Mr. Stafford was going to the fort with vegetables for officers and soldiers stationed there, he wrote. Stafford was on his way to get the horses when he spied a moccasin. Returning home to protect his wife and children, Stafford sent an employee to warn the Ericksons. She came like a whirlwind, skirts a-flying, and said, "The Indians are coming down the canyon." Stafford and Erickson followed the tracks up Bonita Canyon and over Whitetail Pass before turning back. The Apache had taken one of Stafford's horses, but otherwise left the settlers alone. The Chiricahua Mountains were set aside as a forest reserve in 1902, and Erickson became one of its first rangers. His homestead in Bonita Canyon served as his headquarters, and he likely created some of the earliest horse trails into the future monument. When a promotion in 1917 required Erickson and his wife Emma to move away, they left their two daughters, Lillian and Hildegard, in charge of the ranch because their son Ben had enlisted in the army. Hildegard had been inviting friends for brief stays and by that time was considering opening the ranch to paying guests. "Much against Lillian's wishes, I started the border business," Hildegard wrote. When our business was a proven success in the fall of 1917, Lillian gave up teaching and came home to assume managership. An aspiring writer with a genius for branding, Lillian named the business Faraway Ranch because it was so god-awful far away from everything. After Yahoo's death, Lillian and Hildegard bought the Stafford homestead. Hildegard later got married and moved away, leaving Lillian to run the ranch alone. Lillian wrote to her father, "With you and Mama in Flagstaff, Hildegard married and myself tied up with notes, there seemed nothing else to do but stick or die." Perhaps still not resigned to her destiny, Lillian went to Los Angeles to study writing in the summer of 1922, but she returned in the fall, and the next year she married Ed Riggs, whose family had settled in the Sulphur Springs Valley in 1879. The couple returned from their honeymoon with plans for extensive improvements to the guest ranch. They also began exploring the area Lillian called the Wonderland of Rocks. Recognizing its commercial potential, they promoted the area through chambers of commerce and the county fair. With help from an American Legion committee in Douglas, they also began campaigning to make the Wonderland of Rocks a national monument. In August 1923, Ed led Governor George W. P. Hunt and a party of 60 reporters, photographers, and business leaders through the area called the Heart of Rocks, following a trail Ed and Lillian had built for the visit. Hunt threw his support behind the campaign, and the efforts were rewarded with Coolidge's proclamation the next year. With no funds to develop recreational facilities, the designation didn't change much beyond the name. For nearly a decade, the monument remained under the administration of the U.S. Forest Service, which used private contracts to build the first road into Bonita Canyon and also added a small, primitive campground. In 1930, as the Great Depression devastated southern Arizona's economy, local business leaders met with Coronado National Forest Supervisor Fred Wynn to lobby for a better road that would reach farther into the monument. Under Forest Service supervision, state and federal road crews broke ground on the new Bonita Canyon Road in 1931. Built as the monument's central artery, the road was designed to create a series of visual experiences highlighting formations such as the organ pipe formation and the C-Captum before terminating with a sweeping view at Masai Point. It becomes a road with a genuine climax, the Tucson Citizen declared, for when it has been finished, it will bring the traveler suddenly upon the great area of this rocky wonderland, the likes of which there is no other on this continent. As the road neared completion in 1934, business leaders began planning an ambitious dedication, both to generate publicity for the monument and to justify a CCC camp to develop it. The Park Service's Southwest Monuments Superintendent, Frank Pinkley, visited in April and soon afterward applied for the camp. The next month, a CCC unit from Tucson Mountain Park moved to Bonita Canyon, setting up on the Riggs's Silver Spur Meadow, and Ed signed on as trail crew foreman. During the next 6 years, enrollees improved the scenic drive and constructed all visitor and staff facilities, including hiking trails, the monument's headquarters, a fire lookout, and three ranger residences. They also enlarged the campground. Among the Southwest National Monuments, only Bandelier in New Mexico saw as much development by a single group in such a short time. But the first order of business was to prepare for the dedication set for Labor Day. The dedication committee envisioned nothing less than the biggest outdoor gathering ever held in southern Arizona and publicized it in newspapers as far away as Los Angeles and El Paso. Members expected as many as 10,000 visitors would experience the wonder of Bonita Canyon Road before arriving at Masai Point. There, speakers would hold forth in a natural amphitheater from a dais constructed of local rock, a view of the wonderland of rocks and the Sulphur Springs Valley spreading out below. Everyone but the Park Service was excited. The idea of tearing up 4 or 5 acres to accommodate parking for a one-day event gave Pinkley the jitters. It was too high a price, he said, lobbying to instead hold the dedication ceremony at Faraway Ranch. How much change of appearance can we impose without laying ourselves open to the charge of vandalism, he wondered. If asked, the Park Service would have to explain without irony that it was all done to dedicate a monument created to hold it for all time in its original beauty for the enjoyment of untold generations. The committee was undeterred. Initially expected to require 10 men laboring for 1 month to complete the work on Masai Point, preparations instead required all of the camp's resources in men, machinery, and equipment, and the appearance of Speaker's Rock, created in haste by men who had not yet honed their skills, so distressed Park Service engineer Walter Atwell that he offered to tear it down and rebuild it. I would say it was a disgrace, he said. Still, the event was declared a rousing success despite some disappointment with the attendance and the absence of a key speaker from the American Federation of Labor. The weather was mild, an Army band performed, and Kittredge shared the rostrum with Wynn and U.S. Senator Harry S. Hurst of Arizona. Today, only Speaker's Rock remains to mark the event. Enrollees built an orientation station on one of the temporary parking areas. When Camp NM2A closed in 1940, the federal government turned the buildings over to Ed and Lillian Riggs as compensation for the use of their land. The Riggses operated Camp Faraway at the location for a few years before selling the meadow and buildings to William Sprague, who further developed them into the Silver Spur Guest Ranch. Ed died in 1950, and after operating Faraway Ranch sporadically, Lillian shuttered it for good in 1970. The ranch properties were sold to the federal government to be included in the monument. The camp buildings were demolished, but the alligator junipers that enrollees planted and an enclosure they built for their pet bear cub remain, along with 2 stone fireplaces Sprague built into the camp's former mess hall. In 1976, most of the monument was designated a federal wilderness area. Despite Kittredge's prediction of national fame, Chiricahua has remained something of a hidden treasure, which the confusing designation might partly explain. Visitors often show up looking for a plaque or statue, not realizing the entire area is a monument. National park status could end that misconception and raise the site's profile. In the meantime, 20 Erickson family descendants plan to attend this year's celebration, which this time will be held at Faraway Ranch. No doubt, Frank Pinkley would approve. And this concludes On This Day in Rock History. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.